Hey, listeners, we're nearing the end of our 15th anniversary fundraising campaign, and we need your help to meet our goal. This campaign offers you a chance to win a unique food and music experience in one of the most exciting cities in America. Here's how it works. Donate to HRN and you'll be entered to win dinner for two and two tickets to a concert in one of eight amazing cities: New York, Los Angeles, Philadelphia, Nashville, Las Vegas, Charleston, Ardmore, Pennsylvania, and Asheville. All donations support our work educating food system storytellers. And when you donate, you can choose one of those cities and you'll be entered to win dinner and two tickets to a show. So help us reach our goal and enter to win dinner and a show in the city of your choice. Check out heritageradionetwork.org/15 to donate and enter to win today. That's heritageradionetwork.org/15. Thank you.
Restaurants employ over 15 million people nationwide, and two-thirds of all restaurants are independently owned and not part of big chains. Yet currently, these small businesses are not represented in government relief negotiations. Roar is working to change that by fighting for relief opportunities for all restaurants. Roar is advocating for an 8-point plan in New York State that will allow restaurants to reopen and rehire when the time comes. Dozens of industry leaders have signed on to the plan, like Nam Wa Tea Parlor, Field Trip, Momofuku, and many more of your favorites. You can join them at change.org by searching for ROAR, Relief Opportunities for All Restaurants.
Hi, and welcome to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palacio. On this COVID-19 pandemic journey through culinary history, yes, it is April 2nd, 2020, and as you all know, we are in the midst of our coronavirus pandemic, and that coronavirus pandemic announcement caused widespread panic buying. A lot of others considered it just stocking up to stay at home. At any rate, it led to a lot of buying and hoarding by some. But you know, the fear of famine and panic buying have a long history in the human condition during times of crisis. Just think of the last time a big snowstorm or hurricane or tornado was predicted. And what happens? People historically rush to the supermarket and buy duplicates or triplicate supplies of bread and milk and, you know, all the other staples, which often include ice cream and pancake mix. Go figure. But those would be pandemic cravings. At any rate, it's anxiety, and anxiety triggers hunger, and then a fear of not having enough to eat, real or not. So pandemic buying and hoarding, and suddenly the shelves are empty. And a lot of people wonder, well, the supermarket shelves are empty. Is the supply chain broken? Have we run out of food? Well, we've been assured that there is plenty of food in the supply chain for now. The reason you're seeing the empty shelves at the supermarket is because of how much frenzied buying there's been. And with that huge spike in demand, retailers and suppliers and the whole supply chain really have a difficult time refilling the delivery trucks and restocking. So it's really that's what's causing the empty shelves. In an interview for a recent Wall Street Journal article, Roland Ford, a former Walmart executive, said that food sellers he spoke to in mid-March told him they sold 3 months of supplies in 10 days. Nobody keeps 3 months of worth of anything around anymore, he said. Well, that same Wall Street Journal article gave some historical background to explain it. In the past, I'd say 2 decades, they said, producers and large grocery chains such as Kroger's have gone from keeping several months of inventory on hand to holding only 4 to 6 weeks supply. The article states that after a brief recession in the early 1990s, the industry came under pressure from investors to, of course, improve profit margins. Companies settled on a strategy called just-in-time supply, and that aimed to produce, ship, and stock as few goods as possible to meet the demand. by decreasing the capacity of their distribution centers, retailers saved on rent. You know, those warehouses cost a lot of money to keep up. So they saved on rent and labor and utilities, and distributors saved on fuel and wages. Manufacturers cut down on capital that was locked up in unsold inventory. So in this recent month's period, the grocers just weren't prepared for the pandemic. Many food suppliers are now ramping up production, sometimes sending incomplete orders to give retailers at least some goods to sell. And if you've, I don't know, I have not been to the grocery store, being in that age group that is told to stay at home, but I have heard that people are going to the grocery stores and now finding that certain things are back on the shelves, of course. But they're also stocking items that sell rapidly rather than that wide variety of products. And as factories ramp up production, they say that they need the ingredient suppliers to do the same thing. So it's kind of this domino effect. Those companies, too, got used to keeping less inventory around. Some examples of what was affected is retail sales of paper towels, black beans, and canned tuna rose almost, almost 150% in the week that ended March 14th versus the previous year, according to Nielsen's market research team. And according to a Wall Street Journal survey of U.S. grocery stores from March 15th to March 17th, the most common items out of supply were dried pasta, rice, bread, eggs, canned beans, frozen foods, dried beans, bottled water, and don't forget, toilet paper. Concurrent with these articles, a friend and a colleague, James Malin from New York University, went shopping with his wife, and he noticed that there was no prepared tomato sauce, although at that time there were still cans of tomatoes on the shelves. He posted his findings and curiosity on this in the listserv of the Association for the Study of Food and Society. He wondered if others on the listserv noticed specific items missing from the grocery shelves. And with that, he opened a floodgate of responses from around the country. People reported on their findings all over, and a typical pattern seemed to arise. No rice, no pasta, no flour, no beans. And on my last trip, which would have been about, 2 weeks ago, to the large supermarket to prepare for our stay at home, I too noticed the usual empty shelves. But what interested me the most was the lack of dried beans. And I had noticed that on all these other lists of surveys of missing items, those ubiquitous bags of beans that often go, or seemingly go, unsold for weeks and just sit on the shelves were now nowhere to be found, nor were even the canned varieties. Surprisingly wise choices in the pandemic shopping habits. I have to say, my faith in American cooks was restored, even if my pantry was not. But I was curious. Beans are possibly the oldest cultivated crop in the world and have been around since prehistoric times. And they're one of the most important food sources in history. So I decided to invite, as my guest today, the author of the soon-to-be-released book, Beans, A Global History, so that we can find out a bit more about this important food source. Natalie Rachel Morris is a food systems instructor, a food and culture scholar, and a trained culinarian. She's the founder of the award-winning farm and food directory, Good Food Finder, and works at Arizona State University. She lives in Phoenix and joins us today by computer in our remote recording. Welcome, Natalie.
Hi, welcome. It's nice to sort of be in person.
Yes. Well, I don't know if anyone notices or hears the difference, but our recording is a bit different because, yes, we are recording remotely via the internet. And you know, at least we can be in a conversation, have a conversation, and then people around the country or around the world can hear about it and then have their own thoughts on what's going on. But this book on beans is, it interested me, as I say, because I was, you know, I was really, quite frankly, surprised that the dried beans were the first to disappear. I thought, whoa, has Instapot really taken over the country and everyone's cooking beans quickly? I mean, people usually shied away from dried beans because they were, you know, a longer process to soak them and then cook them. And but as I say, they at least, I guess, are educated and realize it's a good source of food and has been for a long time. So I want you to tell us all, how long have these beans been around or cultivated? I guess they had to be cultivated for us to know that they'd been around. And where did they originate?
Sure. And, you know, I'll start off by saying I'm really glad that they've also been flying off the shelves, and my faith in people cooking and that kind of thing is renewed as well. I think that's so great. I start off the book by talking a little bit about going pretty far back in time and talking about our predecessors who had beans. The earliest beans that we know of really were what we would think of as a green bean, just a crunchy, sweet snack that, you know, was more of a vegetable. And, you know, beans are vegetables, but what we think of as a green bean, they would have had as a fresh pull off the vine snack. And yet in its earliest forms, it was probably pretty stringy and unpleasant to eat. And yet at some point along that line, when man discovered fire and put that together into a cooking format, things changed. And along with other foods, they were able to start cooking. And when you cook any type of food, it becomes, you know, the structure of that food, it becomes a different type of item. And so beans did too. And they were less stringy. They were now more something that they could more pleasantly chew. And that was the first turning point for enjoying beans. And if you think about a bean, it's just a pod and it has the beans inside, but that's how they were first enjoying the beans. And they were still the sweet, probably even more sweet than what we think of now with a green bean. But that's how they were first enjoying them.
Well, in these early prehistoric times where people have found remnants of beans or something, where do we know whereabouts? The ice plates shifted, everything changed. So I guess it wouldn't matter whereabouts they were. But then farming came into being, and beans moved. I guess they moved around. But before we can talk about beans, we do have to mention legumes.
Yeah.
And all beans are legumes, as you say in the book, and as is a common saying, all beans are legumes, but not all legumes are beans. Can you explain that to us, please?
Sure. So what I talk a little bit about in the book is the sort of the botany of the bean, and that's one of the chapters that we kind of get into the technical areas of some of that. And so when we talk about beans, some of them are legumes and all of that. What I'm referring to is that the larger family of beans, the larger family of legumes is encompassing all sorts of things. So, for example, when you walk outside, you might see clover on the ground. That's actually a legume. That is not a bean, though. You wouldn't pick that up and take that inside and cook it like you would a bean. But it is considered a legume. So that, for example, is something that you might not know is part of the legume family and related to beans. Another one is vetch, which is something that is often used in agriculture, or people living in rural areas might see vetch growing outside. But those aren't something that I would say consumers on an everyday basis think of or maybe even know of are related to the beans that we see in our pantries.
So, Natalie, after the original, you said the green beans were some of the earliest beans, but then when we get into the cultivation period, and tell me about when we're talking, what were some of the earliest beans that were noticed?
So during the Neolithic Revolution, which was also called the Agricultural Revolution, because it came after the Ice Age and it was quite a warm time and pretty fertile and great for growing. Agriculture came about and people figured out they could grow. From that came the growth of the legumes, and some of the earliest that came from that, what is believed is that favas were actually the first beans to arrive on the scene, and that was in the Fertile Crescent, along with lentils and chickpeas. Those were the beans that people started to find wild species of and then cultivate. And organized farming really became something that humans decidedly started to do as an activity and to survive.
Well, I loved how you quoted Ken Albala in your book, who is a frequent guest on this show, and you included his quote. He said, without beans, it's certainly less likely that those early civilizations would have ever risen. And that, of course, is in reference to Mesopotamia. And there, as you mentioned, the Fertile Crescent, correct?
Yes. So I'm really inspired by, obviously, his work, which was the precursor to mine. I note him as the bean historian in my book, and he says that quote, and I really take to it because I think that one of the underlying points in my own book is that beans are not only they're kind of a sleeper candidate. I think I even use that term in my book because they not only help us nutritionally, as he is alluding to there, but they also help our soil in the world and the environment as well. And I think that quote really reflects their dual purpose and how much strength they have.
Right. Well, when you say that they helped us in other ways, and certainly you're probably referring to livestock feed and their use as cover crops?
Yes, both. Mm-hmm. Our livestock feed, in addition to being our own food as for humans, but yes, also they provide critical nitrogen sources. So as cover crops, when they're planted next to other plants, whether it's in farming or, right outside in your garden or whatever, they can provide nitrogen sources and be a natural source of growth to help the plants around you and really fertilize that soil, which in turn helps our air and helps humans to breathe. They're so important.
All right. Well, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, I would like for you to explain what some of the bean cultures were and where they were. So hold on for a minute and we'll be right back.
As the news of coronavirus reverberates throughout the world, we at HRN are especially concerned about how coronavirus will impact our food system. We will use our platform to support the restaurant, agriculture, hospitality, and other food-related industries by maintaining our coverage and operations. As social distancing becomes the temporary norm, podcasts are more important than ever. There's never been a more crucial time to stay informed about the state of our food system and the way that food connects our global community. We're sharing all of our COVID-19 coverage at heritageradionetwork.org/COVID-19. From interviews with nonprofit leaders and journalists, to firsthand accounts from chefs and restaurant owners, to reports on how the crisis is affecting regional farms. Our team is working remotely from all over to keep food radio alive. HRN needs your support more than ever to keep sharing essential stories and resources with our listeners. Make a donation of any amount. Visit heritageradionetwork.org/donate.
Okay, we're back, and I'm speaking with Natalie Rachel Morris, whose soon-to-be-released book is Beans, A Global History. And we are talking about beans, the food that can feed an army, right? And have fed an army, right? I said that we would talk about bean cultures, and that's you specify that in one of the chapters of your book. And so what do you mean by bean cultures? Who were the people, I guess, who were eating the beans?
So I was mentioning a little bit earlier that beans have this sort of power that I think that, and this is why what inspired me to write the book too, that I think that they're attached to so many different things, and our cultures are one of them. I think that so many cultures around the world have been able to have a link to beans and legumes and broadly, and so I open up the chapter with bean cultures by talking just sort of in a spitfire way about how beans beans have been able to connect themselves to various cultures around the world. And for example, right there, right off the bat, I'm talking about how beans themselves are used as different oils within for lighting and that kind of thing. But and those were in early times. But the Scythians of the 9th century in Asia were relying on beans for their to give to their cattle for nourishment. So many connections back to beans throughout really all of history and even now. So that's one of the things that I just feel is so important.
Right. And then as time progressed, it's interesting that there were certain, I guess I would say, bean meccas, right? Peru, for instance, and Africa. Tell us about Peru and the beans that were growing there.
Are you referring to the lima beans?
I guess I would be. The
beans that were grown in Peru is kind of a neat story. It's not necessarily a nice story. It was about colonialism, but yeah. In its own way. But the the bean story that came out of Peru, well, there's a couple throughout the whole book, but the one that's specifically in the Bean Cultures book, Peru is often known, you know, for the potato, right?
Right.
But it has a connection to the bean in the way that regarding the Spain Reconquista regime in 1525, mm-hmm. Francisco Pizarro attempted to conquer Peru, and he founded Ciudad de los Reyes and established roots for himself there. And he wanted to basically defend himself within this city against the native peoples. The Incan people were really quite still recovering from another recent attempt and attacked Pizarro. Unfortunately, they were defeated. But the city was renamed later Lima, after the bean native to that area, and one that I would think most people here in America are familiar with. The name actually refers to Limac, and please forgive my Spanish because I'm not versed in Spanish, but the name means speaker.
Keeper.
Speaker.
Speaker. Oh, speaker. Right. Oh, I read that. Yes. Speaker. Okay. That's interesting. Yeah. There are, I mean, you have a lot of stories. Some of them are very humorous too, about some of the beans and what made it and what didn't make it and what was favored. And, certainly in Roman times, you mentioned fava beans were some of the first, and in Roman times, particularly, they're very favored throughout the Roman Empire. But there was a little problem with the lentils. What was that all about?
The lentils.
The Romans weren't too fond of the lentils, right?
They are not. No, Romans. You know, they had a favoring for favas, but for whatever reason, Romans did not appreciate lentils. In fact, they quite despised them and looked at them as more of a use for they cast them aside and thought, well, we can better use these for materials, but it was less of a functional purpose and more of a castaway. And so Romans decided to, the fun fact in the part of the book where I'm talking about this is that Romans used them as a packaging filler during the shipment of the famous Vatican obelisk. So it was kind of a way to just push lentils aside. The other fun fact in that piece is that one of the first known cookbooks was written out of Rome and by Apicius, and he did snuck in some lentil recipes. So I would be curious to kind of go back in time and interview him and say, you know, why did you sneak these in, and what made right. you want to get that in there and risk your reputation?
Right. They were, that was in the 4th century, supposedly. He wrote that around the 4th century, but I think a lot of it was completed and written later, so it's hard to know when that recipe actually first made it into the book. It might have been later, but I thought that was very interesting as well, since it was not a favored legume. Then I was also interested in something that you brought up, and it was about the African, well, basically Africans and Native Americans, this method of growing. The slave trade brought things and popularized them when they came to North America and in the Western world, like pigeon peas and cow peas and peanuts. But they act. But the peanuts actually and ground nuts had actually been around for a while. But somehow that and then they came back and they popularized them. Correct. Ground nuts.
This piece of the book was actually done using the research of culinary historian Michael Twitty, who mm-hmm. I'm sure you are familiar with.
Right.
And if our reader or if our listeners are not, they should by all means check him out and his work. This piece of the book is I think so important and relevant to today and kind of our social circumstances happening. So it was important to me to be able to write about some of this stuff, particularly reflective of Michael Twitty. But the portion of the book that you're talking about was the British colonization of some parts of Africa, and particularly in reference to groundnut stew and kind of the back and forth changes that occurred with that dish because of what was happening. So the British colonists longed for flavors of home, and particularly Indian curry, which was obviously a dish that was not native to Britain, or the flavors of it weren't, but the reason they were, you know, craving it was because of even more colonization and further back regarding that. But they were really craving that, and so they wanted to replicate it there in Africa, and they used the local groundnut, or today it's made with peanut butter, and they used palm oil, smoked fish, and goat meat to make this stew. And now, because it became so ingrained in Ghana, that Ghanaians now really make it quite often. And it's sort of just taken on different, well, those are the core ingredients. It's also obviously traveled to America and people make it here. And like foods do, it has changed in different ways, but it still has that core element of those foods using that legume-based peanut butter. So it has this really neat in-depth story from West Africa.
Right, right. Well, then we move up to more modern times, and beans just sort of made it around the world. And let us not forget the soybean, right, which is mm-hmm. has been sustenance for so many, of the Asian cultures for so long. The Columbian Exchange and trading around the world introduced all the different types of beans. What were some of the most popular that kind of, I guess we could say, took off, if you will?
Do you mind repeating the question that you just asked?
What type of bean became one of the most popular in, I guess, throughout the world that really took off, or that were, I don't know, and maybe in the Western world, due to the trade exchange post-Columbian times?
Sure. This particular part of the book, the Columbian Exchange, I'm particularly fascinated by overall, because the Columbian Exchange, I think, has had so much influence on where we're at today with our own farming and agriculture.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that one of the beans that particularly, well, maybe I should actually say a group of beans, but I would go with, you know, New World beans as a broad answer to your question, which would be more defined by, at least today, kind of what we've narrowed down with to things like what we know as the white bean or the navy bean and the pinto bean and beans like that, which have really kind of took on the go-to. They're, you know, they're kind of our go-to bean, but those beans really actually do have a really great history in that they were beans that were cultivated. They were already being cultivated here by the native people, and I talk a little bit about that in the book, and I think that's a whole group of beans that are special to the Americas, particularly our, you know, our food culture, because of just how much weight they carry in our in the dishes that are reflective of all of the Americas. And there's quite a few vendors, particularly Steve Sando, Rancho Gordo. I know he's back to your hoarding or whatever we want to label it as during the COVID, but he's particularly seen a lot of increase in business, but he specializes in New World beans and has a lot of information about them.
Right. And his beans are terrific. If you can go to Rancho Gordo and order them from mail order, and they are very good. They're in modern times, there were different groups that you mentioned. They're the bean eaters, or they were labeled bean eaters, and I think many of us are, you know, familiar with that, the Mexicans and the Tuscans and the Boston, the Native Americans, the Bostonites might, you know, not particularly want to be known as that so much anymore. But what can you tell us about these cultures that became known as bean eaters? What types of beans were they eating and how?
Sure. I really love this particular piece because I know that in some ways this has kind of also become, you know, it's not such a nice thing to call somebody that anymore, but in right. some ways too, I think that it's also tied to this thing we're calling food culture, right? You know, I start with Africa because I think it's probably the least told story, but again, it's referencing a lot of Michael Twitty's work in the Senegambian parts of Africa, but he talks a lot about how there are many beans that are really grown there that we use that we don't think or know that really came from that area. And the one particular part of the book that I was really happy to be able to kind of put out there as a fun fact was the, you know, celebratory dish that we make each year at the New Year that we know as Hop and John was actually a dish that the slaves who were brought over, that was actually a dish that they that was their dish, and we now make that dish every year, but have taken it and of course recreated it and Americanized it, Westernized it, but it's their dish, and that gives it the soul that I think that really that's the story there. That's the really beautiful part of it. And then in, you know, going to Mexico, you know, particularly on my side of the country, there's so many dishes that we eat a lot, that we don't even look at the beans that are on the plate anymore. They're just sort of there and hanging out, and they're just kind of tucked into it, like they're tucked in, and we don't even look at there, but they, if they were gone, we would notice.
Right.
And yeah, I just feel like they're so integral. And same thing with the Italians. Carol Cunahan does a lot of really great research with around, or she she did a lot of really great research with particularly Tuscany and how integral the bean is there, but really across Italy, so much so that they call themselves the Mangiafagioli. So
yeah, it's interesting that only some of the many great stories that are in this book and interesting little tales here and there that come out. And of course, you're in the part of the country that, you know, that is, you know, eats so many beans, as you mentioned. And now in modern times, there's this whole thing about people are rediscovering pulses, legumes, beans, you know, that whole family and other uses for the liquid that comes from them. You know, in this era of lactose-free and diets, and I even had when I've had ice cream made with the water from chickpeas and different beans. That whole culture called aquafaba. You wrote about that. That's relatively recent, correct?
Yeah, very recent. And I'm so happy for it. I'm not a vegan. I do eat fairly vegetarian, but I think that it's wonderful that we're not necessarily turning to thinking about, I mean, I know there is this piece of this as well, but we're not necessarily having to turn to fake meat or thinking about meat as, you know, an alternative, but
right.
We're thinking about utilizing plants in order to make our dishes. And I think that that's a really neat thing. And I love the idea of aquafaba in that way. We've gone for years and years about thinking about diets and various food trends. And in that process, beans are often eliminated because of something called a phytate. And it's, in my opinion, a really sad thing. Don't eliminate beans. Beans are so good for you. But, using beans and particularly implementing them in their nutrition in different ways, I think is so genius.
Right. Well, and like back to the Hopping John, just that innate combination that occurred of combining the rice with the beans and in fact completing that amino acid cycle that had to be completed to make them as nutritious as they are. And it's something that just happened, right? And it's great.
Yeah, I really have no awareness of how much people really know about the combination of rice with beans and just how much more, beans are already nutritional powerhouses within themselves. But if you eat them with beans, they become even more of a nutritional powerhouse. So
right.
I think that, when they're paired together, our ancestors knew that, you know, they had this instinct for these things already, I think. And I think returning to that kind of sort of, if I can use the word, sort of guttural instinct, I think is a really neat idea to go with, and just sort of sitting down and thinking about, okay, well, my, you know, ancestors ate this way. It's probably a really good thing. Let me do a little research. Let me think about this scientifically and how it's working.
Yeah.
And then do that.
Well, one thing that I wanted to, as we run out of time, I did want to bring up a use of beans that a lot of people maybe aren't that familiar with, and it's not part of our North American culture. Certainly in Asia and Japan and China, using the cooked beans and even Mexico as a paste, you know, cooking them down and using them as a paste and sweetened then and using it as a filling. And in your neck of the woods in the Southwest, particularly, what I wanted to mention, bring this up to mention, is that at the end of the book, you you have several really fine recipes included in the book. And I thought that was a nice treat to anyone who's reading about history and getting hungry reading about all these beans. But the cooked and sweetened and mashed up beans and used as a filling. Think of the celebratory cakes, the bean cakes, the bean paste cakes from, you know, Japan and other Asian cultures. I mean, and then Mexico as well. Can you tell us about one of the recipes? You don't have to go through the recipe because we don't really have time, but just explain about the, what is it, the tepary bean pie.
Yes, I can. It was inspired by the pie that is traditionally made by the Nation of Islam, who I write about in the book. So I'll let the listeners get a copy of the book and read more about that. But
right.
It is a pie that was invented in order to have a little bit of access to dessert, but eat beans as well. Beans, white beans particularly, were one of the foods that are approved by the Nation of Islam to eat. And so I needed a dessert recipe in this book. And I talked to a friend of mine who is an excellent baker. All the recipes in the book, by the way, are from friends of mine and local chefs, so I want to give a shout out to all of them right now, who I know are doing their very best given our current situation in the world.
Right.
She is a local chef here in Phoenix, and she is she makes these creations that are just wonderful. And so she and I talked about it, and she said, "Why don't I make you that bean pie, but with the tepary bean, which is a native bean to Arizona and our climate. It does amazing here. It grows here. It loves the heat. And it comes in all sorts of varieties." And she picked the white tepary bean to make this pie. And she brought it over to me as an example. And she had given it her own little twist in order to kind of adapt it for this book. And I cannot tell you, I felt enjoyment, I felt healthy, I felt everything that you want to eat when you eat a pie, but also something that you feel when a friend brings you their own cooked meal. And this recipe, I hope everyone enjoys making it. She suggests having it with a little kind of a sweetened fruit syrup and maybe a little whipped cream on the side, which is also very similar with the cream that the Nation of Islam does. But it's just a wonderful pie. She did a great job developing it, and I really hope everyone really enjoys eating that.
Well, it read beautifully, and indeed, we have to give people a reason to buy the book to read about all these other stories and the bean lore. Oh, there are some fun stories on the bean lore and the different cuisines, and you mentioned diets. It's just, for such a little book, for those of you who aren't familiar with the Edible series, there are a series of books that are called the Edible series, and it's all the global history of. And we've had many of the authors on the show. And it's a small format book, but it is just packed with history and information and good things, all good things. And I can't wait. It comes out, when is it being released?
It is released April 13th, but
okay.
You can pre-order. So I suggest that you support the publishers directly. It is available on Amazon, but you can support the publishers directly. The link is on my Instagram, which is at Natalie Rachel Morris. I'm certain you can find it just by searching Reaction Books or University of Chicago Press. And it's just $20. It's a really easy summer read. Yeah.
And fun pictures. Great pictures as well. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. So again, it's called Beans, A Global History, and my guest has been Natalie Rachel Morris. And Natalie, thank you so much for it's difficult times in our world right now, but also the recording has been a little, you know, more difficult than our actual, you know, studio, sitting in the studio. But great job and good information, and I hope we've given our listeners a lot to think about. Thanks for listening to all of you, and I hope that you all stay safe and stay healthy during these times. And again, this has been another Taste of the Past.
A Taste of the Past is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, and more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like. Tell your friends. And please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.